Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. I'm Richard Vobes. This is the audio diary of my life, behind the scenes of a YouTube creator. I think it's the 15th of October 2024. Sitting in bed with the lovely Julia here at just after 7 in the morning.
Good morning.
Cup of tea and coffee in our mugs. And here is the first slurp of the day. Very tasty, thank you very much. Thought I'd do that because do the Naked Englishman earlier than normal. Well, not earlier than normal necessarily, but from the bed, as it were, while we have our morning tea and sort of acquaint ourselves with the day and what we're going to do and what we were dreaming about and all those sort of things. Because I've got an interview at 10 o'clock to do. Had a video to fit in before that. Had, you know, it's only 3 hours to get all that done. I've also got an edit from the weekend to try and at least do most of. I want to get that out this afternoon if possible, but we have a farm trip as well, to go, a farm shop trip. So busy morning, and then I've got another interview in the afternoon. It never blooming stops. It will stop, and I will probably go, oh, I'm bored, I've got nothing to do. But I always have something to do.
No. We'll be on the farm.
There'll
be plenty to do.
I know. There'll be the beautiful cows, the Guernseys to milk and look after, the pigs, the bees and the chickens.
Yes.
You were looking at chickens last night.
Yeah, I think we've decided which breeds we're going to have.
Are you able to say what they are?
Yeah, I can. Plymouth Rock, Sussex and what was the other one? Oh, the Orpington. Because the Orpington is a very good mothering hen. And all three birds are dual purpose and very pretty in their varieties.
Yes. And when you say dual purpose, they can paint and decorate.
Yes, that's it. No, they're meat and eggs.
Meat and eggs. The key there is don't eat them first as meat, because then you won't get the eggs.
Cool, you're not just a pretty face, are you?
No, I'm using my logical brain. Wait till they've done all their eggs. And if you're very lucky, you can get the hens to lay all their eggs at once, 130, and then you can chop them up.
Yeah.
I don't think I've fully grasped this concept, have I? No. Very exciting, though. Nice to be picking them out.
Yeah.
We've got to get the land to do.
Need the land to put them on.
But we are, you know, we've got, so we know what breed of cattle we want, our dairy cows, Guernseys, we know now. Are we still thinking of Oxford Sandy and Black pigs? Because we've been told they've got too much fat on them when they're slaughtered, didn't we?
When they get older, apparently they've got too much fat on them.
Will that make streakier bacon?
I don't know. We'll look into it more.
Yeah.
It's yet to be decided.
Pigs are, I mean, we do know what Oxford Sandy and Black look like because we saw those at My Little Farm and somewhere else. I can't remember where that other place was. Who was having them?
No, that was, what's his name, Clarkson.
Oh, yeah, on his programme. But anyway, we have...
His weren't as pretty as the ones at My Little Farm.
No.
I must say.
We want pretty ones. Because they're easier to slaughter when they look so cute.
Yeah, what are we doing? That's just ridiculous.
So what we want is ugly buggers. Yeah. And so they go, yeah, you look ugly. You don't mind having your throat slit and being hung upside down, squealing away.
Nice.
Anyway, so, you know, and what kind of bees do we want?
Honeybees.
Oh, not bumbles.
Honeybees.
So we want them. But there must be different varieties of honeybees.
Probably, yes. I haven't delved too far into that area either yet.
No.
We've got some beekeeper books downstairs, haven't we?
We do. We do indeed. So, yes, we'll have to have a look. Right, I'm just going to plonk you down over there so I can read to you a little bit from our diarists. And, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. So it is the 15th because I'm just looking at what yesterday was. So here we have Gilbert White twice.
Twice.
Gilbert White in 1775 in Hampshire says, "The beeches on the Hanger and the maples in the fields are now beautifully tinged and afford a lovely picturesque scape, very engaging to the imagination. Then, 5 years later, he said, Hunter's Moon, much lightning and distant thunder. It's curious that he should say distant thunder, because last night, tell them what we were witnessing.
Well, thought it was some sort of lightning or electrical charge in the sky.
But it
there were some
to...
random flashes, but then we realised it was lighting up the whole sky. And then I stared down between at the buildings.
In front of the house.
In front of the house, and where there are some trees at the bottom of this view. So I was staring at them, and I realised it wasn't actually a flash we were seeing. It was a sudden dimming of all the lights, seemingly all the lights on the seafront, just for like half a second, and then back on again.
Yes, and it's like some intermittent issue with the electric.
And then someone told us something interesting.
Yeah, Sean said, Sean James Cameron sent me a thing to say there is a preparedness plan, as I remember it, I have to reread it, for electricity blackouts at 4:30 in the afternoon, when I suppose that's a classic time that people start to cook and boil the kettle, turn on their electric cookers and all of that. And you think to yourself, why have you're making this for the very first time, a preparedness plan, because the grid cannot supply enough electricity. No shit, Sherlock. You put everybody onto electricity. You insist that we have these ridiculous EV cars, which are badly designed so that they need so much electricity, as opposed to the electric cars that we actually had at the turn of the 1900s, because that's what was going on. They did have electric cars and they were running, and we didn't have nobody's households had electricity, but you had these battery run cars which weren't lithium anyway, and so the demand is clearly going to be high, and so they're preparing for blackouts. Now this may be just some narrative that is preparing us to be disadvantaged and not really a thing, which is probably most likely. Or it's folly on their part of switching everybody over to electricity. And if it, either way, I think commentators could argue that it is folly, and they should drop their net zero policies immediately. That's how I would push back with that. But they may say, oh, well, the planet's so bad, we have to do this and all of this crap. And so there you go. Last night, Julia and I finished The House of Ghosts, which is a book I wrote in 2016 for children, a Simon Pickle story. We've been reading it to one another. Quite a complicated plot, but we got through the book, and I think Julia enjoyed it.
I loved it, just like I loved the first one.
That's the second in a series of a trilogy, or more. I suppose, really, I was going to write a series of them if they took off. Of ghostly stories about the ghost detective and his little helper, Simon Pickle.
His right-hand lad.
Who gets involved with this because of a work experience week that he does, or experience of work week, I called it, because he's only 12 and he wouldn't be doing work experience until he was much older.
15.
Yeah. So I thought I'll rename that as an experience of what work is about as from a school perspective. But anyway, he gets signed up to this detective who happens to be somebody working for the police who is a paranormal detective. But there's something odd about the detective. He is very out of time, as it were, drives a Morris 1000 Moggy. Traveller, and has this rather strange suit, this two-piece suit that he wears as his outfit. Anyway, won't spoil too much about that. because you never know, you might go and read it. I can't remember now if I think the first one, The Ghost Detective, which is what it's called, the first one, is available on Amazon. I'll have to check that. It might be. I did self-publish it, and then I wrote the second one, but it's not. It's finished. It just needs the final edit. There's just a couple of... There's a few spelling errors in there, and there's about two little tiny, tiny plot in...
Glitches.
Which doesn't mar the story at all, but you would go, uh-oh, hang on, how did that? And you just need to, you know, dot the T's and cross the I's. No, it's the other way around, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. So... Yeah, and then we're going to start reading another one now called Pink Heads, which is a book version of Snug and Cozy, the TV series I wrote, but it's a lot different to the TV series was just blatant slapstick, but this is the whole story of these aliens that come down onto Earth and they crash land. That's all I'm prepared to say at this stage. Maybe because I can't quite remember it. No, I do. I think there's some good scenes in it. I can't remember it. But I'm hoping it's more than the first draft. I'm hoping it's a little bit more polished. Can't remember. It was at a time when I thought this is what I was going to do. I got fed up with the corporate entertainment and the corporate videos. And whilst I was doing some of the corporate videos, not while I was doing the videos, but at the same period, when I wasn't working, I was writing these books because I wanted to transition out of this this life that I was leading. But in the end, I stopped because I couldn't see how you could market it. By the time, I don't know how many books I wrote, about five or six. By the time I was on the sixth one, I had self-published the first and got that up to speed and everything, and it looked really good, and which is available, Splidge the Cragflinger. And I realised my writing style was not what kids were going to read. Mm. It's too detailed. And when I saw the quality of the writing that was required by people like David Walliams of Granny Did a Fart in the Kitchen, whilst I bathed nude under the sump oil, whatever it was, you know, it was like, oh, we have to write about farts and crap, and the language wasn't very good. Whereas my plots are quite intricate. Because anyway, I don't know why I'm waffling on about that, but there we are.
Oh, excuse me.
That's all right. You're excused.
Thanks.
Yesterday I was reading a little bit from The Farm and the Village by George Ewart Evans. I thought I'd read a little tiny bit more, just to whet your appetite for farming. We find it very enjoyable reading these old books because it's what we want to do, and it takes you into a little bit of
insight.
So this is a chapter 9. I'm not reading the whole chapter, by the way. It's called Sheep and Cattle, and it goes like this. Why have we given so much emphasis in the last few chapters to the growing and harvesting of corn? Well, I assume that's what he's done. The answer, briefly, is this. East Anglia, over a period, has had a very high reputation for its advanced methods of farming. Bear in mind, this was published in 1969, and East Anglia is where George Ewart Evans comes from, or was farming. And funny enough, we have just come back from East Anglia, Suffolk, where we were privileged to stay on Ray's farm after when we were there to watch the threshing demonstrations and interview Mark Byford, the bowler hat farmer, and see the electroculture stuff. Anyway, so that's kind of why I picked up this book, because it's based in East Anglia. Anyway, so yes, it has a reputation for its advanced methods of farming, 1969. And the region had won this reputation chiefly on its ability to grow corn. One of the reasons for this is East Anglia's nearness to the continent. Most of the new techniques of farming came from the mainland of Europe down the years. and this region was on the front doorstep to receive and try them out. Thomas Fuller, the 17th century writer, stated that gardening began to creep out of Holland into England during the reign of Henry VII. And along the Suffolk coast, vegetables, notably carrots and turnips, were grown in gardens at this time. Later, they were sown in a field and became the key crops in the arable farming of the region. Sir Richard Weston, the royalist, who was an exile in Flanders and Brabant during the Commonwealth, brought back with him to England many farming methods that he'd observed over there. Most important of these was the growing of turnips in the field with the purpose of improving barren and healthy land for corn crops, a technique on which the Norfolk improvers, Coke and Townsend, founded their new husbandry in the next century. So it's interesting that they were interested in improving the soil, and of course the best way to do that was to keep roots in the ground. But there was a close link with the continent from early times. East Anglia has always been exposed to military invasion, but it has likewise been in the path of new ideas. There is evidence that corn growing reached a high state of development even before the coming of the Romans, and that corn was sent out of eastern Britain. But whether as tribute or surplus to the region's needs is uncertain. For corn is the natural crop of East Anglia because physical conditions here are perhaps better for growing and harvesting than any other part of Britain. It lies on the dry side of Britain, on the lee side of the prevailing south westerlies, which cross the Atlantic and bring so much rain to the western side of the islands. That's very interesting to note, then, because we're thinking of going west. And it says that's where the rain comes from, but I suppose that makes sense coming across the Atlantic. The hard winter frosts and the dry summers are ideal for preparing the seedbed and ripening the harvesting crops. The soil too, with its large areas of boulder clay and drifted material, form as a result of ice action, and it's very suitable for corn growing. And even in the sandy coastal areas, the chalky clay, the subsoil, is rarely too far from the surface to be trapped and spread on the land as marl. There's a picture here of a marling fork, which is like a pitchfork, but it has three prongs.
No, it's called a marling fork, is it?
Marling fork.
Why? Okay.
For marling purposes.
Hmm.
I'll just finish a little bit here. Corn is the farming crop best suited to the region. But that is not to say that it has been the chief crop throughout history. For nearly 1,000 years after the departure of the Romans, farming was chiefly for use and not for sale of its products on the market. And this meant that the traditional growing corn was mixed with the rearing of cattle, sheep and pigs. It's interesting it says that because I think that's really where we've got to get back to. This business here that is not chiefly for use. Farming was not chiefly for use, was chiefly for use and not for the sale of its products on the market. In other words, not just about a commodity,
yeah.
Flogging, but that people lived on the land and they grew the stuff because they wanted to use it in small holdings, effectively, what we would call small holdings. But the Vikings, the Danes, up in that neck of the woods, as opposed to the Saxons down on the south where we are, probably lived in the same sort of small holdings in their little villages, growing stuff for themselves. Some surplus would have been traded with one another, of course. But we have turned this into an industry of growing commodities. And that, I think, is where things start to go wrong, because you're growing, again, on an industrial scale. And once you do that, you take away some of the love and nurturing of those crops, because you're now, everything is a number. Consider it like being a consumer or a customer of a utility company. You're just a number. You're just one of billions of people who are customers, and then they can't give you proper customer service. We've seen that, have we not, in recent times? You can't get through. Your call is important to us. No, it's not. You would rather we didn't ring, just pay us the sodding money, is their attitude. And it has come, you know, all of these things has come to the point where it cannot continue. So I find that fascinating. I'll leave that there for now. You know, that's what I find interesting about books, ladies and gentlemen. I find that you can take a few paragraphs from a book, which is what I love to do. I've mentioned this so many times, but, you know, pick up a book at random, read a page or a paragraph or even a line sometimes.
And it takes a lion or a tiger?
A lion or a tiger. And especially if it's a zoo book. And it takes you off on a... It can do, you know, a bit of text like that. It makes you think, oh, yeah, it's not just for their use. But they started to begin the industrialization of farming. And so, therefore, the problem then happens that you have a certain number of people growing vast areas of farming. Other people don't need to grow. So they start doing other things. And that's okay. You have supporting businesses like your
butchers,
bakers, candlestick makers, you know, people who are looking purely after the horses, harriers,
like carters.
Carters.
Grooms.
And so on. And then as we went into the Industrial Revolution, you took that one stage too far, that one entrepreneur invests in satanic mills. And instead of having small-scale businesses run by families and sole traders, or small businesses with a small number of employees, you start getting into mass production. And then once you get into mass production, people who are working for it, you end up with most people working for corporations, and they are a cog in the wheel, in the machine. And their customers are now, as we just said, one of millions. And the value, you've stepped over that line where each of you are part of the holistic, yes, this holistic, the holistic nature of business, in which you have a number of customers, you have a few employees, and you have an important product. And 2-3 miles down the road, there's another business that does that. Now, Tesco's, for example, a supermarket, has supplanted all those little shops, and of course other brands are available, that have taken away the little grocery stores that used to care for its customers, used to order in those special things that you would need, and used to have a whole different range, particularly of local produce. And Tesco's comes in, one size fits all. You don't want all of this nonsense homemade stuff and local business. We can supply it from the other side of the world, but it will be homogenized and it'll look like every other thing, and you can walk wherever you want around the land and you'll get the same range of tat.
It'll be bland and uniform.
And that's where we are. And there's, you know, what's the logical conclusion from that? Well, ultimately, as we've seen, BlackRock and whatever the other one is, owns, you know, you trace back all these companies, they're all owned by the same bankers. And in the end, you'll just get the same products, the same range of products. So you go into a supermarket and you think, oh, there's a great range of products. No, actually, there isn't a great range of products. We were watching the Riverfords video they put out yesterday about farm washing, in which they pretend there is a number of farms. It's all brand names. So-and-so farm and such farm producing different vegetables or different things. And it turns out, no, it's a big factory. They have these different names. And so that range of products is all from one place, not the great range that you first thought it came from. And they're all the big Unilever, BlackRock, and all these people who own all this stuff, all being now shoved with chemicals, petrochemicals, keeping the prices absolutely cheap as possible, and gently, slowly, but assuredly poisoning and keeping the population down. Because you say, well, why would they do that? Because they're in bed with the pharmaceuticals, getting kickbacks from all the pills that then, once you've kept the people ill, that they're going to buy the little white pills, which is why in the supermarkets you can buy all these ready off-the-shelf crap that will also start poisoning you. And if you can't see it, you are really blind. I thought you were going to say
I
something.
did have something poignant to say, but it went about 2 minutes ago.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Did I finish my coffee?
I don't know, did
Yeah,
you?
pretty much. Anyway, there we are. That's my thought for the day. So this is why I fight so much, because we need to get back to that point, pull back from where we were, where the supermarkets own everything and everything is bland, that we get back to these small family-run businesses who are thinking about the locality. They don't need the same profit margins. They don't need the same number of customers. And they don't need to have surpluses in any huge amount, and they can produce their own stuff. And then the diversity of that, as you travel around a country or a region, you'll see different products, like you used to get the Mulberry pork pie, or the Shrewsbury cake, or the what's the cheese with the blue in it?
A blue cheese.
Blue, yeah, but what was the famous one?
Oh, yeah, the
Yeah.
one you went to see.
No, the one that everybody has when it's got mould in it, the mouldy cheese, I forget what it's called. Anyway, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And all these different places had their own things, and now it's all very bland. You know, Cumberland sausages actually came from Cumberland. Lincolnshire sausages came from Lincolnshire. And
Cheddar cheese came from cheddar.
cheddar cheese came from cheddar. And you'd go to these places to find out their little Lancashire hot pot, for example. And yes, you might find a few of them scattered about as you get closer to Lancashire. You might find, oh, there's more Lancashire hot pots, or more Mulberry pork pies, or a Cornish pasty, whatever it was. And that's what made moving about very interesting. Now, if you can just buy them all in a supermarket, and they're all mass produced, and they're not mass produced, sorry, they're not produced in anywhere near the region by the people who actually know what they're talking about, you have just got Blandsville. And our lives are being transformed into Blandsville, and we're being dumbed down to the point where we don't give a monkey's, because we're so damn thick. We're so busy watching television and seeing everything in shiny packets that is filled with colourings and flavourings. And I mean, only yesterday Julia put something on one social media platform, which I won't even mention the name of it, because why would we want to advertise anything about the farming thing? And even then, somebody was saying, oh, don't do the supermarkets down, they're really trying to help people. And you just go, you do not know. You do not know the extent of how these big corporations are all in bed with one another, and they've all agreed to a an agenda. You just do not know. And there are none of these big brands that are independent and genuinely looking after people.
Do you know, I don't think it is that they don't know, because they do know damn well.
Who? The
well,
people
people
who
in
reply?
general, I mean, it's quite common knowledge that supermarkets are not a good thing.
Yes, but I meant that person that had
yeah yeah
you were
yeah
saying she
yeah
seems to be defending the supermarket.
yeah It's like, oh, but some people can't afford to go shopping, farm shops and stuff. Yeah, well, you can't really afford to shop in a supermarket either, because hey, you buy all the extra tat that that you're attracted to because of, well, you the kids are anyway. And B is just all
Well, the
the
supermarket
processes you go
food
through.
argument won't wash. People say you can't afford to buy in farm shops. That's rubbish. Absolute right. I don't hold that argument at all. Yes, it might be a bit more expensive. That's very true.
But you need less of it.
But exactly. So whereas in a supermarket, you'll probably start your day with cornflakes or some of this tatty, nasty, nutrient-free food. And rest of the stuff that you'll have. You may have two or three meals a day. If you go to a farm shop, you only need one meal a day because suddenly you are getting all the real nutrients. If assuming you get proper farm food, because there's farm shops and then there's farm shops. There's pretend farm shops who just import tat and they just have
crap.
Yeah, and they look like a farm shop, but they're not actually on a farm and it's none of the farm stuff. That's true. So there does seem to be a dearth of real farm shops. That's very true. You have to sort of locate your farm shop very carefully. But if you actually eat real farm food, it's got proper nutrients and minerals in it the way you're supposed to have them in your body. And you don't have all the extra flavourings and preservatives and sugars and other heavy metals and crap, which you're being secretly fed in the farm food stuff, whether it be in their vegetables, which are all coated with stuff and pesticides and goodness knows what, poisons like, what's that stuff called? Not ringworm, Roundup, which is a glyphosate. And all of that, you're being slowly poisoned. And people just still defend the supermarkets because they're so used to the convenience and they're so used to filling their basket in one go.
It's also all the hormones in the meat.
And then there's, yeah, exactly.
And everything else in the meat.
Everything.
The hormones has got to be a big thing, you know.
At some point, you've got to get to grips and realise that this is not the way our species are supposed to eat.
Supermarkets and doctors are not your friends.
Anyway, 31 minutes. Right, I've got to get up. Things to do, people to see, phone calls to make, letters to write, podcasts to upload. Until the next time, thank you so much for watching. Oh, and a girlfriend to kiss, so I better do that. Till next time, toodle pip.
Have a jolly good day, everybody.